It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Madison library is hosting its second Drag Queen Story Hour. We'll find out where the idea came from, and we'll hear from the performer about what it's like to read in front of a family audience. First, the Wisconsin Assembly approved the $3 billion incentive package for Foxconn yesterday. The Taiwanese electronics manufacturing company is planning to build a $10 billion facility in southeastern Wisconsin. Laurel White has been following the story. She covered the assembly session yesterday. She's WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what exactly got approved? I'm sure broad strokes here. I'm sure there are a lot of fine points here.
Yes. So what got approved in broad strokes was the $3 billion incentive package for Foxconn, which includes some tax incentives for them and some waiving of environmental regulations for the state, like reversing the course of streams, building on lake beds, filling in wetlands, things like that.
This passed almost on a party line vote. Can you talk about the exception? Some Republicans voted against, some Democrats voted for.
That's right. It was a really interesting vote. We don't see folks crossing party lines all that often in the Capitol on high-profile things like this. So there were three Democrats that joined 56 Republicans in voting for the deal. Those three Democrats were Peter Barca of Kenosha, Todd Onstad of Kenosha, and Corey Mason of Racine. So those are all folks, all lawmakers that represent areas that Foxconn is expected to locate. It's supposed to be, you know, in southeastern Wisconsin. And I think we have some tape from Corey Mason, who's the Democrat from Racine, a speech that he gave before he cast his vote last night.
Yeah, here's a listen.
When you hear the voice of hope and doors that you knock on and constituents who are hoping for a better future, all the politics fades away.
I understand some of the Democrats who voted in favor of it had concerns, but couldn't, as Representative Mason said, close the door on that hope, as they put it.
That's right. And, you know, I think it's important to note here that Corey Mason is actually running for the mayor of Racine right now. So he's out there, he's talking to constituents, and his feedback was, you know, I just heard too many people that from my area that supported this, that were excited about this, the opportunity for up to 13,000 families supporting jobs in a community that had manufacturing as a real driver of its economy for a while and is lacking that right now. So he said that, you know, that was compelling enough for him to move away from the majority of Democrats that voted against the package.
I also want to give a listen to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, a top Republican in the Assembly. He also represents the southeastern part of the state. Here's a listen to his encouragement for passage of this legislation.
What we need to do more of is we need to invest in things when we look at it like a field of dreams. It's a field of dreams just beyond the interstate when you're driving down I-94 between Milwaukee and Chicago. It's a field of American dreams. It's careers that people can buy a home and send their kids to college. And when they graduate from college, they don't have to leave and go to another state. They can stay right here in Wisconsin.
And a lot of Republican supporters of the legislation talked, maybe not in such poetic terms, but in similar kinds of language, didn't they?
That's very true. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss certainly has a tendency to be very poetic about things that he's very invested in and engaged with. He gives kind of lofty speeches sometimes, and this is something that he said was one of the most exciting pieces of legislation that lawmakers were likely to vote on this session. And you heard in that little kind of mini clip of his speech, he touched on several different points that supporters of the package hit on again and again last night during debate. And the last thing he said there was people from Wisconsin who grew up here, go to school here, staying in Wisconsin. And that's a point that supporters have made rather frequently. They talk about Wisconsin's brain drain, so people who graduate from college here and then move out of state because there aren't opportunities for them. They say that Foxconn will reverse that, that people are going to be excited, they're going to want to stay here, work in high-tech manufacturing, and be a part of this new economy in the state.
Talking to Laurel White about the Foxconn legislation that passed in the state assembly yesterday, still needs to go to the state senate to be completely passed. I want to get into some of the opposition to this, Laurel. Gordon Heintz of Oshkosh, one of the Democrats who voted against, here's a listen to someone he had to say yesterday.
The three pillars of economic development where state government can play a significant role should be in infrastructure, education, and entrepreneurship. And they require long-term investments by state government. The opportunity costs of not investing in transportation, the future education of our children, and further incentivizing and supporting entrepreneurship in order to make cash payments to a foreign company worth billions is not worth it.
And that price tag is part of the concern from Democrats there, some Republicans, and some conservative groups. What kind of things did people say about the $3 billion in incentives?
So what Hintz is hitting on there is really one of the primary arguments that opponents have made, is that it's just this deal is too risky and too expensive for taxpayers. So we saw in the analysis that came out from the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau last week that at its peak, so at the most expensive, when the state is projected to pay out the most money to Foxconn, it's going to be about $325 million a year. So it would be more than $600 million over a biennium. And lawmakers will have to figure out how to fit that into a state budget. And the point that Hintz is making there is it's possible that if the economy declines, that other programs are going to have to get cut so the state can continue to pay what it's committed to pay Foxconn for creating jobs and making capital investments. So that was really a consistent point that Democrats and those opposed to the bill hit on many times during debate, that it's just expensive, there aren't enough protections, it's too much money over 15 years.
One question that's been raised, an issue on both sides, is how many jobs, how big an investment will this actually be coming from Foxconn? What sorts of concerns were raised there?
Well, the primary concern there is that Foxconn is not going to create up to 13,000 jobs, which is the maximum number projected right now for the facility. But also that, you know, even if it does create that many jobs, that some of the folks employed there are going to come from Illinois. So it's not going to be entirely Wisconsin residents. And there's kind of a spinoff to that concern as well, that some of the construction companies that would help build Foxconn or suppliers that provide the materials that they need would be Illinois companies, not Wisconsin companies. So people were trying to put amendments on the bill that would require Foxconn to hire Wisconsinites. Now, that's, as opponents to those amendments say, in violation of the Constitution. They can't do that. But it's certainly a concern that people have that it's not going to be 13,000 Wisconsin jobs.
And then there are other concerns about the environment. There are waivers that are part of this bill that would allow Foxconn to do a variety of things that would normally need a permit without that permit. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so those are things like, you know, reversing the course of a stream, which you currently need a permit from the state to do that, filling in wetlands, building on lake beds. Those are things that you need a state permit to do. Foxconn would be able to do that without getting a state permit. And opponents to the bill say that that's just too much, that Foxconn should be held accountable in the same way that businesses in Wisconsin are held accountable right now, that they shouldn't get special treatment and get these things waived. There is also the argument, one of the Republicans that voted against the bill thinks that everyone should be granted the things that Foxconn is granted in this legislation, that there shouldn't be special treatment, but those waivers should apply to everybody, which is an interesting angle.
This is passed now in the Assembly, not a done deal yet. The Senate would have to get into this. What do things look like there?
So we just heard earlier today that the Senate has announced a public hearing on the Foxconn package. That's going to be at 11 a.m. on Tuesday in Sturtevant, which is about 30 miles south of Milwaukee. It's near Racine, in the area where Foxconn is expected to build. So that's the first step in the Senate process, the public hearing. Then, of course, we'll get the vote in a committee from the Senate, and then it'll go to the floor. So the process is rolling starting Tuesday of next week.
I had seen a comment from someone who said, hey, this is a budget item and needs to go to the Joint Committee on Finance, the Budget Committee. Is that true?
Yep, that's what's going to be hearing it on Tuesday. That's
okay, not just the Senate. That's Joint Finance.
So, yeah, the Senate actually referred it to Joint Finance. So, yeah, and that usually happens with bills with this kind of financial fiscal implication. So $3 billion, it's expensive. Folks wanted it to go through the Finance Committee.
Is there any indication that this thing won't pass ultimately?
I don't think that there's any expectation that it won't pass. We've heard that from legislative leaders pretty consistently. We've heard from Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald that he doesn't expect the Senate to make any major changes to the bill as it is right now. So we're not aware of any prevailing concerns, I guess you would say, in the Senate that would keep it from passing.
Now, this passed in the Assembly yesterday. Also, the Assembly passed a resolution unrelated to this one involving the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia last weekend. What was in that resolution?
So they kicked off session yesterday, which was, of course, focused on the Foxconn bill, with a nod to the violence in Charlottesville. They actually had a prayer from five different leaders from different religious faiths. Normally, there's just one prayer. And then they passed the resolution that you mentioned, which specifically condemned white supremacists, the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, and, quote, all those who rely on violence and hatred to advance their cause. So they unanimously passed that resolution, and a few lawmakers stood up and spoke to its importance as well.
All right, Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, WPR's state capitol reporter. She brought us up to date on the $3 billion incentive package for Foxconn. That plan passed the Assembly yesterday and moves on to the state Senate. Reading to kids is a great way to get them excited about reading themselves. And story hours at libraries are one way to do that. One Madison library has picked up on a new kind of story hour that's happening in communities around the country, story time with a drag queen as the reader. Holly Stork-Post is the youth services librarian for the Pinney branch of Madison Public Library, and Craig Schlegel performs drag as Miss Greta and will be reading at the drag queen story hour tomorrow at Pinney Library. Holly, Craig, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Holly, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Holly, let's start with you. How did you and your library learn about this idea, the Drag Queen Story Hour?
Sure. So I think a couple of us originally saw something on Facebook about drag queen story times happening in other libraries. I had seen a couple, my colleague Danny, who was really the motivator behind this event happening with the Madison Public Library, saw some and sent them to me. And we started watching some videos of this and really got excited about the idea.
And why did you think it was a good fit for your library?
So we love doing all sorts of fun events. Story times are kind of the bread and butter of children's services, helping kids get ready to learn how to read. And Drag Queen Story Time specifically is really meant to spark the imagination and play of children and introduce the idea just kind of gender fluidity and get kids looking at some great role models and seeing some inclusive and diverse readers in their lives.
Well, let's bring in Craig now. Craig, how long have you had the alter ego of Miss Greta?
I have been Miss Greta since February of 2013, so we're going on about 4.5 years at this point.
And how did you get involved in this Drag Queen Story Hour?
Well, Danny, Holly's co-worker, he contacted me to be a part of it, and I had worked with him before with the Madison Gay Men's Chorus to do a cabaret I was hosting for that, and he thought that I might be a good fit, and it's been really great, especially the first one was.
And Holly, yeah, how did that first one go? What were you thinking going into it, and how did it come off?
Yeah, it went really well. We didn't really know what to expect, but we had a huge turnout. We ended up tweaking our program a little bit on the fly to fit in more people. We had about 200 people in the library that evening. Lots of families, kids of all ages. I think we had babies on up to, 7 and 8 year olds. And everyone was just really, really excited about it and having lots of fun.
And what was it like? This, I imagine, is a different crowd than you'd usually be up in front of, Craig.
Yes, absolutely. It's a far different crowd. Usually I'm used to dealing with people between the age of 18 and 25, and the capacity dealing with them is much more vulgar. So having to cut back on all sorts of things.
You can't work blue at the library.
No. I kind of got in the mind space of dealing with one of my friend's daughters. She's 2 years old, so just kind of being with her and reading stories and just kind of translating that into a large crowd.
So why do you think it's important for kids to meet a drag queen, to be read to by a drag queen, and other people who might be different than the people they're usually encountering in their day-to-day lives?
Well, I feel in the community, drag queens are seen as more of a a gross thing. You go to a bar, you see them, you don't see them in the daylight. They're kind of like vampires. They're this mythical creature that
which
people
is
kind
of cool too.
Yeah, absolutely. Except we don't drink blood usually. But it's nice to interact with the community more on a wholesome basis, to mm-hmm. know that we are actual people, and this is more of an art form to us versus like we go out, we party, we drink, we swear at a crowd of people.
And from the library standpoint, we really wanted to offer this story time in order to present something that is just kind of normal, making this an experience that is not a spectacle, not something to be pointed at and stared at, and really encourage kids to just get used to accepting differences and seeing people who may or may not look like them and their families.
We're talking about a drag queen story hour at a Madison library, the Penny Library. Holly Stork Post is with us from Madison Public Library, and Craig Schlegel, a.k.a. Miss Greta. So how did the kids respond, Craig?
It was surprisingly amazing. All the kids will run up to you. They'll say hi to you, even though you're 6.5 feet tall and wearing a brightly colored wig and a terrifying outfit. But children have such a bright outlook on everything. They just come up to you, they say hi to you, they ask you, what's your name? Where are you from? Are you a boy or a girl? And it's just nice to be able to talk to them in such a common way and such an easy way that they understand whatever is going on.
And Holly, how did you see the response from patrons, parents, and kids?
Very similar. So I saw lots of kids, of course, who were just having fun, dancing, singing, really excited, dressed up. One mom with an older girl were some of the first ones to arrive, and the mom shared that her daughter was so excited because this was the first drag queen she'd ever met in real life. She'd only ever seen them on TV. Another family whose kids had lots of fun. They didn't tell the girls anything about what the program was, just that it was a special story time, and their kids love story time. But through the course of the program, their older daughter said, I don't think that's a woman. And so they got to have a really open, honest discussion about it in a safe place that was based on their child's own knowledge of the world. And so that was amazing. It was great to, we had a number of families who expressed their gratitude for just a really inclusive, inviting program.
That's interesting, Craig. I mean, a grown-up might not want to ask the awkward question or have the awkward conversation. Is there something about kids that are a little more unfiltered? They're a little more open to this conversation.
Absolutely. Children of all ages will come up to you and be like, are you a boy or a girl? So it's an easy discussion to be, I am a boy. This is a character that I play to entertain a crowd of people, just like a clown or an actor would do. And they're like, oh, I understand that.
And obviously you've had one and you're about to have another event. The response was good enough to have an encore presentation.
Absolutely. We had lots of people who couldn't make the first one and said, oh, I hope you do it again. We had families who expressed interest in having a monthly drag queen story time at the library. Lots and lots of enthusiasm and lots of asking for additional programs, which is why we're having our second one.
Well, Craig, we can get a little taste of this on the air. You've brought a book. What are we going to be reading from today?
I will be reading The Family Book by Todd Parr. And the first story time we read Be Who You Are, who is also by Todd Parr, and that went over really well. It's very simple book, bright colors. You can easily read to the children, and they can kind of react to it and have fun with it as well.
Okay, do you want to give us and this is the one you're doing for the second event,
yep,
right? Okay.
For tomorrow morning, we will be reading The Family Book by Todd Parr. Some families are big. Some families are small. Some families are the same color. Some families are different colors. All families like to hug each other. Some families live near each other. Some families live far from each other. Some families look alike. Some families look like their pets. All families are sad when they lose someone they love. Some families have a stepmom or stepdad and stepsisters or stepbrothers. Some families adopt children. Some families have two moms or two dads.
And Holly, were you part of the selection process for the readings?
I was. I have pulled a number of books to have on hand for the event. We'll also be offering a book list of LGBTQ picture books for families who are interested in reading more. But we selected these books because they are kind of topical. They talk about inclusivity and diversity in kids' families and lives, but they're also really great for working on those early literacy skills, which is really the reason behind all of the story times and library programs we do. So they offer lots of chances for kids to interact and respond and kind of follow along, and there's a little bit of some responses and parts where kids can join in.
Craig, are you you're doing this encore performance? Are you hoping to do a bunch in the future?
Yes, absolutely. If we could make this a monthly, bi-monthly kind of program, especially because the people that I've seen come out are so happy to have a member of the LGBTQ community just living their life and experiencing with the children and kind of giving their view and their art on the world, like, as they see it.
And Craig, do some of your colleagues, other drag queens, come to you and say, hey, I want to do this too?
I think that at least one or two people have contacted either me or Holly or Danny to say that they are interested in it, which is a really great thing to have other people in the community excited about the program as well.
And Holly, this is at one branch within the Madison Public Library. Are you hoping to take it on the road to other branches, maybe even other libraries around the state?
Yeah, so this was our first one that we started with to kind of see how it went. But we definitely have plans to expand with our programming, specifically with Drag Queen Storytime, but hopefully looking at other kinds of programs we can offer as well. So a number of my colleagues have been interested, and I've gotten a lot of just kind of questions and people who are looking forward to hearing about how it goes.
Holly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Craig, thanks for coming up.
Thank you so much.
Holly Stork-Post is the Youth Services Librarian at Penny Branch of Madison Public Library, and Craig Schlegel performs drag as Miss Greta and will be reading at Drag Queen Story Hour tomorrow morning at Penny Library. Now it's time for Food Friday. This week we have a question for you. What name brand favorites, the foods you might buy in the snack aisle at the grocery store, would you try or want to try to make at home? Cheez-Its, Oreos, Pop-Tarts, breakfast cereal? What store-bought goodie would you try to make at home, or have you made at home? What would make it worth the work to cook them in your own kitchen? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or head on over to the Central Time Facebook page. Find one of the recipes we'll be talking about while you're there. Lori Skelton is one of WPR's in-house foodies and a Food Friday regular. And for this segment, she's been experimenting with making store-bought favorites in her own kitchen. Lori, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, what started you down this path, Lori?
What started me down the path was the idea of making your own Oreos. It's not something that I really crave a lot of these days. I know when I was in college, I would go through bags of Oreos on a weekly basis, but it's something that I've gotten away from. I will buy a bag to share with friends, but it's not something that I'd really want to do myself. Looking at this particular recipe on the Serious Eats website, however, got me to thinking about when you can control the amount of sugar, the amount of salt, and can leave out some of the other things that may not be so good for you, maybe it's worth trying to make your own. And we tried a couple of different things. Some did work. I'll be honest, a fair number of things that I tried didn't work this time, probably because I'm not as good a pastry chef as the creator of the original recipe.
And you were inspired in part by Stella Parks and a lot of things on her website and a book she has coming out. Can you talk about her and what she tries to do?
Stella Parks graduated from the Culinary Institute of America in 2002. She went on to be pastry chef at some really high-end restaurants. She was named a Best New Pastry Chef by Food & Wine magazine in 2012. She's now one of the senior editors at Serious Eats. And her book, Brave Tart, which is the name of her personal blog, that came out just a couple of days ago. She calls it Iconic American Desserts, and she does have great chocolate cake, and she does have great cherry pie, but this is a woman who makes her own Almond Joys, and makes her own animal crackers, and gluten-free Honey Grahams, and makes her own Fig Newtons, and makes her own Butterfinger candy bars. You can't help but be intrigued by, can I do this in my own kitchen?
Well, one of the ones you did try, and you mentioned it, the Oreos.
Yes.
Somebody called them Foreos. Was that Stella Parks?
That's Stella
Foreos,
Parks.
And we called them We did a tasting of these. You can see this on Facebook. Veronica came up with L'Oreos,
which I was so honored.
So, talk about what goes into making our own Oreos. Spoiler alert: they were good. I like these.
They were good. And when Stella Parks is making something that is going to be a filled sandwich cookie, whether it's her own version of Oreos or her own version of E.L. Fudge, the vanilla cookies
with
chocolate in the middle.
Which I saw online. I'd love to try that. Yeah.
Not making it. A lot of her cookie doughs are fairly easy to put together. They've got a few things, however, that you're not going to find in the store-bought version. She uses a lot of egg yolk in her cookie doughs. Oreos are like that. If you look at a package of Oreos, you won't see egg on there at all. The other thing you won't see on a package of real Oreos is coffee flavor. Oreos do say that they have chocolate and artificial flavors, mm-hmm. but she actually goes out and uses instant coffee powder to give her Oreos that dark, slightly bitter taste. You don't want a sweet cookie when you're going to sandwich it between all that sweet cream filling.
Oh, that's a good point. Now, I didn't ask you this the other day. How much work went into doing this? Was this just a big production?
Well, considering I made two batches, I made a regular and a gluten-free.
Right.
It did take up several hours in my kitchen. But of the recipes that she has, this was probably one of the most straightforward. If you're going to start with anything, I would suggest you start with her Oreo recipe. It is fairly easy to do. One of the things, though, you have to be patient with, because this dough has egg in it and a fair amount of other moist ingredients, you're going to have a dough that's, when you roll it out thin enough to make it into an Oreo, you're going to have to actually almost scrape it off the kitchen counter sometimes. And so you do need to handle the dough a little bit carefully. Once it's in the oven, however, they cook up in about 12 minutes. You let them dry out nice and crisp, and then you put in your choice of either butter, cream filling, or all-vegetable shortening cream filling. The all-vegetable shortening is probably closer to what you're going to find in a packaged Oreo. And during our taste test, I think both you and Veronica preferred the butter version,
which was a little less like the original Oreo.
But if you're out to make an Oreo that has, say, a flavored filling, mm-hmm. which is all the rage these days, I would suggest actually stay with the butter version. If you're going to use the recipe that we've got online or that's on the Serious Eats blog, and you're thinking about, well, maybe I could make a mint Oreo, or maybe I could make a coffee Oreo, I'd stick with the butter version for the filling.
Talking to Lori Skelton on this edition of Food Friday. We are replicating store-bought treats at home. Again, you can find that recipe for homemade quote-unquote Oreos. Go to the Central Time Facebook page or WPR.org. And mentioning the gluten-free version reminds me, one reason you might want to do this yourself is, hey, I love those treats, but I don't want, say, the gluten, or I don't want things with a whole ton of preservatives in them. That's maybe one motivation to try to replicate these treats at home.
And one of the things that we discovered when we did our taste test, Veronica said that she thought the gluten-free version made the chocolate flavor of the cookies pop a little bit more. Now, I don't do a great deal of gluten-free baking, so it could just have been a happy accident in my kitchen, or there could be something in the science behind that, that using a gluten-free flour will let other flavors come to the fore. But yes, certainly, if you are concerned about gluten, I would definitely look into making your own version with gluten-free baking flours. For one thing, doing a quick price comparison, there are gluten-free chocolate sandwich cookies out there. Oreo doesn't make them. Nabisco doesn't make them, but there are versions from other companies. They run 2 to 3 times the price of an Oreo. And I would bet you if gluten-free is something you're really concerned about, you're probably saving money by making your own gluten-free Oreos.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Hodge with us in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to know how to make Fruit Loops.
Fruit Loops. You're a big Fruit Loop fan?
Hmm.
Well, I used to be until I realized that I couldn't pronounce the ingredients.
Yeah.
And you don't trust fruit that's spelled with two O's either, I imagine.
Yes.
All right. So
they're delicious.
I did.
They're yummy, and you looked at some of the cereals that they have online. Not necessarily Fruit Loops, but people try to do this.
I'm tell you what, Hodge, go ahead and try and Google this, because I'm sure somebody out there has. What Stella Parks has done is make her own Lucky Charms.
Lucky Charms, okay.
And to the point where she's making her own, I mean, it's easy to make a marshmallow these days. There are a lot of recipes for cushy, soft, pillowy marshmallows. But those little crunchy half styrofoam marshmallows that you get in Lucky Charms, which I must admit, when I was 4 years old, I was addicted to those things. You have to do a few special things in order to get that texture, down to the point of you have to make your own kind of corn syrup. And I will be honest, I can't do that in my kitchen. That's just too involved. But if you're really jonesing for some really good Lucky Charms, and how much safer can it be to make your own corn syrup? There you go.
Well, good luck finding that online. But yeah, that brings us to the point you brought up earlier. Some of these things are going to fridge too far. They're just too long or complicated or take up too much refrigerator or freezer space.
One of the things that she has on there that I thought would be so easy is to make your own conversation hearts, you know, that you'd hand
out.
Oh,
like on Valentine's Day.
On Valentine's Day.
I don't like eating those.
Well, and
does anybody?
Well, she makes a point that the flavors they've chosen for them are terrible, and she gives you better flavors for them. The problem is you're talking about serious candy cooking. You're starting out by making a dough that you need Sprite in it in order to get the right consistency and the right little tang. And then you have to go and add the wintergreen flavor or the clove oil, or again, not something that I was ready to do to bring in for public radio. But if you're someone who, say, wants to throw a Valentine's theme party where maybe you use the little candy hearts as Scrabble letters for a game, and if you've got the time, this would be something fun to do, but you're going to have some serious candy-making skills to put this together. Same thing with her version of Milk Duds. I thought, I love Milk Duds. I never get Milk Duds anymore because they do kind of taste a little bit funny to me now. Mm-hmm. And here she gives you the exact recipe for how to make the caramel the right consistency, just gooey enough. And then she says, go ahead and dunk it in your favorite dark chocolate and you'll love it. Getting caramel to this particular consistency requires more knowledge of sugar than I have. If you're a candy baker out there, go to the Serious Eats and find her Milk Duds recipe. I'm sure you'll love it. I can't do it.
Food Friday regular Lori Skelton stays with us as we continue our conversation about making store-bought goodies in your own kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever tried to recreate something from the snack aisle at the store at home? Why did you decide to try it? How did it come out? Is there something you wish you could make at home that you want to try? Lori might have some advice, or she can point you in a direction or steer you away from it if it's too hazardous. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're getting back to our discussion now with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about making our favorite store-bought treats at home. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What would it take for you to attempt to make your favorite name brand treats at home? Or is there something that someone you love really likes to eat at the store? Maybe you want to make it for a special occasion, a birthday, a wedding, you name it. Have you done this? How did it go? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers. Elizabeth is with us now in Random Lake. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi.
Have you done something like this before?
Yes, I was going to say that my family makes a thing with toast, peanut butter, and sorghum. And then we add chocolate pieces on top, and it tastes like a Butterfinger candy bar.
Okay, but you're eating it on toast, Elizabeth. Does that kind of ruin the illusion?
No. No, it doesn't.
Sorghum as opposed to chocolate. Now,
oh, no, chocolate too, right? You cover it in chocolate after.
Yes.
Oh, you do. Okay.
Yeah, and not blackstrap molasses or anything like that. Get really light sorghum.
All right.
And this, Elizabeth, I got to ask, did this come out of years of experimentation, or did you just kind of wing it one time?
Oh, years of experimentation.
And you're a Butterfinger family.
Yes.
Elizabeth,
100%.
Thank you so much. That's a great one. I love that you kind of meet it halfway, because actually Butterfinger is one of the ones I think you said to me earlier, Laura, you did not try.
I would love to make my own Butterfingers, but this, to get that kind of layering, to get that peanutty crunch in the middle of the candy bar, they're talking techniques in the kitchen that Mary Berry from Great British Bake Off would say, uh-uh, not going there. It's you, in order to keep the middle pliable as you keep layering it, you have to put it in the oven for 2 minutes, warm it up, soften it up, then take it out, mold it a bit, put it back in the oven. It's again, I can't.
You know, actually, that reminds me, thank you, Elizabeth, for that, because I'm never going to make a candy bar at home. I will take graham crackers, put some peanut butter and chocolate chips on it, toaster oven for 12-15 seconds. It's a candy bar like experience, and that's close enough for me, and that's really easy, and I like that.
Which gets back to the central question about all of this: is it worth doing? Because so many of these treats are, it's not something you plan for. It's, you just sort of get hit in the middle of, boy, I really could use a host of Snowball today. And does that mean you go in your kitchen and spend the next 3 hours making them? Or do you go down to the corner store and grab a package?
From a health perspective, actually, the I'm only going to eat it if I make it approach might be a really good idea.
Which, of course, is the perfect idea. What having this in your arsenal does is it makes you think about what it is you're eating. Mm. And it certainly, we can get really esoteric here. What is the nature of a Hostess snow cone? Is it the cake? Is it the marshmallow? Is it the coconut on the outside? You can get really, really involved in what makes the experience a true experience of that particular food stuff.
We need a food philosopher in here I think. Back to our callers now. Mickey is on the line in Hartford. Mickey, hi.
Hi. As I was listening, I was remembering a book I read 4 or 5 years ago called Make the Bread, Buy the Butter. It's a really good book about a woman who saw peanut butter sandwiches for sale in the store and couldn't believe that you could buy a peanut butter sandwich. And so she decided to find the cost of making a peanut butter sandwich versus buying one. Mm-hmm. And that led her on to all kinds of other things that you buy, mayonnaise and cake mixes and butter. And the nice thing about it in her recipes and her discussion is she not only has the cost of things, but she has the hassle factor.
Mm. And Mickey, what was the highest hassle thing that you tried yourself?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not a really great cook, so I enjoyed the discussion of her life. She even went on to have chickens and goats, which is, beyond.
That's really going to the source. Mickey, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate it. I can pull off a peanut butter sandwich, but I like that philosophy, though, that here's how to make it. Here's how much hassle it is to make it. You make the call at home.
Mm-hmm. Or the flip side of that, yes, go ahead and make your own peanut butter sandwiches and then go out and buy your own Cheez-Its.
Mm-hmm.
So it does come down to a trade-off. What is it worth to you?
Thanks a lot for that call, Mickey. We're talking to Lori Skelton. It's Food Friday. We're trying to replicate store-bought treats at home. Back to your calls now. Stephanie is on the line in Eau Claire. Stephanie, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about, Stephanie?
Well, I was wondering about the macaroon cookies that they make in Ripon, Wisconsin.
Okay.
They're the harder one, and then they have like almost like the coconut vanilla cream center.
Mm.
Mm,
okay.
It's a sandwich cookie.
Okay. I know of what you speak, but that's not something that I would certainly attempt, and I know it's not something that Stella Parks attempted, so that's not in the book. Sorry.
Okay, and is there something particularly challenging you think about trying to do that, Lori?
Again, you're coming back to what is the real store-bought experience versus what can I make? I can certainly make about 3 different kinds of macaroons, with or without coconut and with or without more of a lighter almond flour. But am I going to be able to recreate what they do in Ripon? I highly doubt it.
Well, and if they're made here in Wisconsin, we can call them homemade. I think, Lori.
All right.
We'll expand the definition
there. I'll call that a compromise.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for calling. And you mentioned Cheez-Its a few minutes ago, and that's the other thing you made and brought in to try. And you did gluten-free.
I did a gluten-free Cheez-Its. Version
so
of Cheez-Its.
So talk us through what went into that.
This is fairly easy to make. Again, it's one of these thinner doughs. It's very light and very easy to roll out. And you basically take one of those big half-sheet pans, spread dough on it, run a little pizza cutter or a knife to make it into tiny little one-inch crisp crackers, and then bake for about 15 minutes. I found out the hard way where the cool spots in my oven were because it did not bake evenly. If you are going to try the Cheez-Its version of Serious Eats from Stella Parks, I would recommend, she says split the dough in half and make it in two batches. I'd go three or four batches so that you can give your dough more room to spread out. So when I brought in the gluten-free version, several people said, you know, the taste is fantastic. And I was using just basic store extra sharp cheddar. The taste is fantastic, but the texture is not quite right. It's just a little bit pillowy. It's not as crisp. So I went back and I did make a version with regular flour. You notice I didn't bring any of those in?
Uh-oh. What happened?
They didn't leave the house.
Oh, because you ate them. Okay, it wasn't a disaster. Okay. They were too good for us.
Here's the thing. I'd never had a Cheez-It before in my life.
Really?
Really. I know. Where have I been all these years? But I'd never had a Cheez-It before in my life. I made this one batch with regular flour and just basic store cheddar. And I noticed, oh, well, these on the end are a little bit burnt. I can't bring those in. I'll just eat those myself. And before I knew it, the pan was gone. If these are easy, if you want to try something for yourself, you may want to try making Stella Parks Cheez-Its from the Serious Eats food blog.
I'm not a big Cheez-It guy, so this one probably wouldn't be one I'd try to do at home either. But one you didn't make, but we were talking about earlier, fudgesicles. I used to love me a good fudgesicle. And this is something that looks like it's not too crazy out there to make.
No, actually it isn't. It's not a pudding pop. She's very quick to say it's not just a matter of dumping chocolate pudding into the freezer. But if you have molds to make your own kind of frozen treats, you need a decent quality chocolate, you need skim milk, and you need a little bit of gelatin. Beyond that, these are pretty straightforward. So here we are, the final weeks of summer. Maybe you can go out on a really high note with your own fudgesicles.
Lori, hassle is no object. Money is no object. What is the one treat you wish you could make at home that we haven't gotten into yet? I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well, actually, something I didn't find out about until today. It plays off of the Oreo cookie dough. I was working from her website because I didn't have a copy of the cookbook. It only came out on Tuesday. She uses that Oreo dough to make her own homemade thin mints.
Ooh.
I know what I'm going to be doing this weekend. Thin. Those are also not going to be coming to Wisconsin Public
filling
Radio.
Sounds like it'd be tough, though, isn't
it? No, this is your Oreo cookie dough with some peppermint and a few other things added, and then you dunk them in your favorite dark chocolate. And no, I'm not bringing any in on Monday.
I guess the one I would want, and I had a habit, maybe even a problem with these. I've kicked it since then. Little Debbie. I could list about six or seven Little Debbies that I loved.
Her oatmeal cream pies?
No,
nope,
that's
are in
not
there?
One of them.
Okay. But she does have her Christmas tree cakes are in there. You can try making your own Nilla wafers if you want. She's got some really good ideas. I will bet you if you want to give your kids a great project, this might be something for you and the kids to do, or the grandkids to do together.
Yeah. Oh, not my kids in particular. I think they'd have no patience for that. But your kids might. Lori Skelton with us, Food Friday. You can find that recipe and to try and make your own Oreos at home. Look on the Central Time Facebook page. I have a bonus Food Friday question for you. First, some background. My wife and kids, they were out last night, so I had dinner on my own. So I made some foods that I like and they hate. On the menu, salmon burger, beets grated and sauteed in butter, and sauerkraut. I was happy to eat it. They were happy to miss it. Here's the question for you. Is there a food that you love, but everyone in your family or your circle of friends can't stand? Are you a old-fashioned liver and onions person? Are you a broccoli lover in a group of broccoli nevers? Are you a tofu fan and a steak family? Let us know about the food that you love and they hate. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Laura, you've got one of these.
I call it single girl pasta for a reason, because it's a pasta, usually a filled pasta, that I dress with, oh, anywhere from 2 to 4 onions that I've let slow cook for about 40 minutes and at least 3 to 4 cloves of garlic. It's amazingly delicious, but trust me, nobody wants to be around me when I'm eating it.
But I would, see, that's one I would happily eat. I think a lot of people would eat, but then, yeah, everybody could kind of avoid and quarantine themselves afterward.
Yeah, I eat it on Saturdays when I'm alone.
Beets and sauerkraut, are you with me on this or
against
me?
Absolutely.
Share your food that you love, they hate on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.